The Idiot Players are very pleased to bring you what we intend to be a series of conversations with important thinkers and beers and doers. The Idiot Players podcast aims to explore art, creativity, and expression. If there is an elephant standing in the dark, as the Sufi story goes, we want to do more than grope and theorize. We invite conversations with people who aim from the heart to make practical the far-reaching. Hello, and welcome to the Idiot Players podcast. I'm your host, Gregory, and this is episode 18 of the podcast. A word about an upcoming podcast. I'm looking forward to speaking with psychotherapist Russell Schreiber, who has just published a book entitled Gurdjieff's Transformational Psychology, The Art of Compassionate Self-Study. As much as I've read so far in preparation for our chat, the book is excellent, in that it maps Gurdjieff's ideas into a practical therapeutic context, mapped by a practitioner with many years of experience working with people at large. The emphasis on compassion is most noteworthy. Schreiber's work goes a long way to update and recontextualize Gurdjieff's ideas on how to work with attention, and in particular with his idea of Kundebuffer, a complex of ingrained behaviors and attitudes that separates one from a more essential experience of self. In this episode, 18, we offer another tour de force conversation with Tony Blake, centering on the theme of systematics. Systematics is the method that J.G. Bennett came to as a means of synthesizing and integrating his own insights into the nature of things with what he learned from George Gurdjieff. It's fascinating and important material aimed at bringing our patterns of thinking out of the habitual level and allowing for important new insights. In fact, Tony will be facilitating a workshop on systematics, the 15th, such workshop at Claymont Court in West Virginia from May 2nd through the 4th, 2014. It's really an excellent opportunity to meet him and to work with others interested in this field of inquiry. I've posted a link to the workshop information for those looking to follow up on this opportunity. And lastly, if you enjoy and support our work at idiotplayers.org, we welcome you to click through on the main page and donate what you can to help pay for web fees and even to support my own travel to such conferences as this, so I might network and continue to bring high-quality podcasts to you. That would be outstanding. This podcast conversation was originally recorded on Saturday, February 8th, 2014, and is being published on Saturday, March 1st, 2014. Anthony Blake, it's wonderful to welcome you back again to the Idiot Players podcast. We're both in the midst of a cold winter, and hopefully we can warm things up with a conversation about systematics. This is what we've set for ourselves today. So welcome.
Indeed. Thank you, Gregory. Glad to be back. And this is going to be, in some ways, a formidable topic to tackle. Yeah. And so we hope our listeners out there in advance, through some kind of psychic power, wish us well and support us in this.
Yes, kind of energy they would be sending now, a kind of a predestination energy or something like that.
Oh, you're going to get me off on this, because one of my passions is the notion of sending help back to the past, to oneself in the past. It's been played quite an interesting role in my own life, my own feeling about myself. So we could into some interesting fields though, but we better not.
Okay. Now, I want to start before we sort of sketch out some of the historical background to systematics and sort of dive into the topic as best we can, to let people know that you're intending a systematics gathering. It looks like the 15th gathering, May 2nd to 4th, 2014 at Claymont Court in West Virginia. So can you let our listeners know a bit about that?
I'd certainly love to. As you've said, it's the 15th, which is quite a chunk of time to be doing this. And what these gatherings have taken on board is to go further with the elements which Mr. Bennett left us and make them more accessible in terms of different examples, different techniques, his connection with other methods, and so on. So over 15 years, quite a lot of ground has been covered. This particular one, I've said I'm going to concentrate on the first four systems and what a system means. That word system means we'll get into a bit later on. Mm-hmm. But these are the almost like the basic forms of thought which are to be found in just about every culture possible across history and across space. And I thought it was time to look at them in terms of what... So, okay, we got them as ideas or as concepts or as images of something, but how does it help us? How does this help us in the modern situation? How does it help us make sense of what's happening around us? And I believe they do make a lot of sense of what's around us and are helpful. So my focus this time will be on that, the four systems, first four systems, as disciplines, as ways of thinking, because really this was, you know, when Bennett first proposed the systematics, this, he called it a method of thinking. Hmm. And so it's an action process rather than answers. You know, it's something for us to do. And that's what I want to help people along with in this forthcoming event.
Bravo. Yeah. And I'm hoping, hopefully I'm not springing this on you unawares, but I know that you've been working on a book. And are you prepared to tell us a little bit about that and when we might see that coming out?
Oh, that your last question has made me shiver in my bones.
I sprung that on you.
I'm finding this book extremely difficult to do, even in a sense more difficult than my last one on higher intelligence, because it's a matter of getting it right. And what this means would take a lot of explication. But I am indeed working on this, and at the moment I'm, as I say, I was drowning in material. And so I'm in an interesting field of trying to find an organization. We'll come back to your comment, and not come back, we'll come to one of your interests in perhaps later on about structure and so on. Mm-hmm. Find the structuring to encompass these things, which isn't artificial and which is organic and living. And so I'm like, in the writing of the book is going to be very significant for me, because it's not as if it's a matter of taking ideas and material which I have and writing it up, because I could do that, and I've done that. I've done almost thousands of pages about systematic. No, it's this: what is the action involved in it? What is it really about? And so I have to constantly go over the material and refine it and refine it. So it's an ongoing process, so I can't answer your last question.
Okay.
I'm in the throes, you see, and I'm an obnoxious author complaining about his troubles.
Well, we're a sympathetic ear, but is it I know that you have gone back and looked at a lot of ancient coding systems, number systems, so it's in the territory of systematics. Would that be fair to say?
Oh yes, indeed it is, just to be quite clear. I use a very open term for this about the meaning. It's really about the meaning of systematics, meaning of systems, meaning of number, and all of that which I should be concerned with. And so the emphasis is on meaning. So it'd be semi-historical, semi-psychological, semi-methodological, and all those logicals we can think of. But it's meaning is the important thing. How does it? What does it mean? What is it for? What's? And these questions bring us into the areas we perhaps will discuss later. The area of will, intention, purpose, and intelligence. And it then reflects back on me as an author. I can't just do this lightly. And I, as you know, Gregory, in my writings and so on, I really strive not to come across at all as any authority or somebody with any special experience or anything like this, but simply to share with people what I have come across and make it there on the table. So they look what's on the table.
Well, I think that I'll just jump in to say that you do that masterfully, that, you know, the, I guess I could offer the phenomenology of meaning, you know, just, you know, presenting yourself as here I am, I'm in the midst of this particular question. How is it that I'm proceeding? What does it mean to be where I'm at? You know, asking all these kinds of rich questions. I took in about 15 minutes of a talk that you gave some years ago at a business conference in Milan on YouTube, where you were talking about the supreme art of dialogue.
Oh, yes, last year that was.
Oh, was it just last year?
It was just last year, yes.
And it was masterful the way that you, you know, stood on stage and, you know, allowed yourself to go back over the question that you just asked and to kind of root it more deeply into the moment. And that really came through, and I suspect that that's what you're talking about, this process.
God, absolutely wonderful. Yeah, that was a interesting event for many reasons we're going to, like, just add almost irrelevantly, but it was wonderful. They got me in a hotel which was just across the road from the church in which there's Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper.
Wow.
And it was just being cleaned and made available to the public. I couldn't believe my luck after all these years to be able to see the Last Supper itself.
And they had just unveiled it, like, after extensive cleaning.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. The timing is rarely like that. Okay. Well, that's, you see, if this world we're going off onto, we've got into Leonardo, who could really comment on Leonardo, but he belongs to this realm of constructive intelligence, which I think is of concern to us all. And he exemplifies also the aspect which is has been an attempt by Bennett to incorporate it in the systems of this integration across diversity. Because, as you know, he was an engineer, scholar, physician, obviously a great painter and so on, scientist. In him, science and art melded together. And I think this is, for me, a fundamental characteristic of what systematics ought to be about. Well, we better get on to that.
Indeed. So tell us, paint us a picture of, because you were there, working closely with John Bennett, developing these ideas of systematics. I think it would be interesting for the listeners to get a bit of that historical picture. Where did it come from? What was he looking to do with it, etc.?
Oh, right. It's like a life story in 5 minutes. It's something as an immense compression here. Because I was a very young man, amongst other young men at that time, in the sciences around Bennett, and this work of his had already been in progress for 20, 30 years. And so we joined it at a certain phase, a very interesting and critical phase. Now, to what I say is the summary will be, of course, an artifice. It's a very abstraction of many different things. But part of it, the setting must be that he was writing the last two volumes of his four-volume dramatic universe, which had taken many forms over the years before that, And it was, I think you'll be mentioning soon, you've been looking at volume 3 of this, which gives a summary of his ideas on systematic. Well, a lot of some of this, at least, came out with conversations, because he was wonderful in that respect. He would just open it to people, like especially young people like myself, and say, what about it? Let's look at this. Let's do it together. And he was very was a sort of democratic and one of the boys as we were doing this, and open to all sorts of suggestions from other people. Okay, a turning point was this, that, as you know, if your listeners don't know, John Bennett was one of the leading pupils of G.I. Gurdjieff. And, of course, we haven't got time to stop and say who Gurdjieff was and what he was about, if we could even start. But he was a very remarkable man, a kind of spiritual teacher with none of the attributes of what may be conjured in the mind by a spiritual teacher, that somebody in the robe being pious and talking about enlightenment. And he was also very down-to-earth, incredibly knowledgeable, very intelligent, very creative, down-to-earth, active. He was sexually active, physically active, artistically active, in all kinds of ways. And he lived through revolutionary Russia. He married a Russian lady-in-waiting of the Tsar, in fact. And so if you imagine something like the Russian Revolution, but in terms of some internal spiritual development, and of course Russia itself was full of this, with Rasputin and the Tsarists, and the theosophy, and all kinds of, and the cosmicists, Russia was a hotbed of more interesting ideas. But just as an image, you can take the sense of a kind of inner revolutionary striving to change human nature, which was externally attempted in Soviet Russia. He was attempting internally. And he, doing so, he, of course, brought together the cosmological side, the vision of the universe, with the psychological, and said these were inextricably connected, and so on. Now, I am beginning to go off into an exposition of Gurdjieff, which I shouldn't do. But he wrote a series of books. The first one is most well known, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is a 1,200-page novel, or kind of science fiction novel, about an observer from another solar system looking at human life over thousands of years. But this notion of the all and everything was the primary thing which affected Bennett. And it was this encompassing of all this human history, the creation of the universe, the evolution of man, the states of consciousness, how people transmit ideas from generation to generation, art, the creation, why art exists, and so on, the nature of science, all a tremendous range of material. And this impressed him, because Bennett himself was a polymath, because he was his great-grandfather was a famous mathematician, Cayley, and he knew some, had a great background in the sciences.
His great-grandfather was Cayley, the mathematician?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
So he had that, genes were out, and he had that current in him. And that's why mathematical models and so on were fairly amenable. He was the manager of industrial science and fuel research in England. And so he was very versed in the sciences, but also knew many languages, possibly 15 or something like that. He knew some, of course, Turkish very well, Latin, Arabic, Persian.
Italian, I think, was one of his first.
Oh, yeah, Italian. Right? I always take that for granted. Italian, French, German, Latin, of course, and some Greek. Because I say to people, in those days, they were educated people, not like today. And so he really knew this tremendous range of stuff. And so naturally for him, this diversity of history, science, religion,
psychology, psychology, etc.
And psychology, and so on. And also the modern things to do with management and organization also intrigued him a great deal. So that's the kind of all and everything he was immersed in his own career. And then he came heavily influenced by Gurdjieff in the spiritual sense, and he, as O.L. Bennett, took up the, the teaching or the cause, and he continued to do it during his life of remarkable men, and found himself in this role of an expositor, explaining to other people, making it accessible to them, which he did about Gurdjieff's ideas during the Second World War, even at the time when he thought Gurdjieff was dead. So that way, you're going to see him, his whole passion with his diversity of experience, he traveled, his range of skills, his interest in Gurdjieff, being brought upon to explain things. And so he, at one point, began to see what his vision was, and it was to combine what he relished and appreciated emerging in mathematical physics with the spiritual teaching of Gurdjieff. And it might seem crazy or strange to people now, but that he really was going for that. He thought that the modern mathematical physics, since beyond relativity, would accommodate the possibilities that Gurdjieff talked about. And it would accommodate it because it would go involved into more dimensions and the obvious dimensions and so on. So that was quite a thing. And he had a firm conviction about it and developed a multidimensional geometry beyond space and time, and even got a paper with some colleagues published in the Royal Society. So it was no just fancy. He had something solid behind it. Now, this thing about combining so spirituality and mathematical science, it is typical of him, also typical of systematics, because these are usually things which are divorced from each other and lying apart. But for him, it was never like that. They never could be apart. Everything in every field would be relevant and mutually relevant. And that was his standpoint. Now, if I just say one more thing, then you can chip in, because I don't want to talk at length, you know, without some pause here.
Yeah.
One of Gurdjieff's main, pillars in his teaching was his concepts or teaching about laws. And we may come to this question of laws later on. It's quite a problem understanding what laws mean. But one gets a general idea. And he always talked about the law of three and the law of seven. Now, it's like Gurdjieff is inseparable from the law of three and the law of seven.
Yeah,
law of three.
Yeah, certainly in, you know, Beelzebub's Tales, it's very soon in the book, and it runs as a thread throughout it for sure.
Indeed, and it's there are many possible reasons why it's three and seven, but he gave it special names in Beelzebub, as you mentioned, in three is tria masakamno. It sort of means I put three together and do, and I may come back to that later. It's an interesting formulation. That's what the word means, tria masakamno. Mm. Then the heptaparaparshinok, which is the sevenfoldness, hepta. And the first one is about how things are connected, and the second one is about how things change, very roughly. Now, because of Bennett's interest in exposing, he wanted to kind of what I would call make a kind of apologia for this cosmology, in sense of not to excuse it, but to justify it and explain it. And in 1950, by the time 1951, he had written a kind of first draft, or one of many drafts, in fact, of the Dramatic Universe, and had dealt there with this the three numbers, one, three, and seven. One being for being and wholeness, three for will, and he made this strong identification of three and will, and the seven for function as a process. And at some point, you can see the later published version, which came out in 1953, if I got my dates correct, has made a jump. Something happened. It's very extraordinary. And I wasn't there at that time. But what had happened was that he thought like this. He said, well, I've been talking about the one, the three, and the seven. And Mr. Gurdjieff always talked about the three and the seven. But what's wrong with the other numbers? It sounds a very naive sort of question. And because it came from his kind of scientific background, you see, which is that bent, which is to say, in a Leibnizian sense, I come hopefully back to Leibniz sooner or later, has to be a fundamental reason. You know, what is the an adequate reason for this selection? And he could say, well, if you can select a 3 as being significant and a 7 as significant in some special way, then you must do it for the other numbers as well, because there's no reason why you shouldn't.
Right. Well, you can't get to 7 until you get to the other numbers. There's that sort of straight-ahead way of looking at it, but yeah, for sure.
That sort of way. And then he himself, and again, a lot of the story, I can't say exactly why he did this, but he went as far as the 12, because this has, in fact, immense historical precedent. The 12 is some kind of totality or summation of the lot. Anyway, so he thought, wow, I'm going to fill them in. And in the volume 1 of the Dramatic Universe, what he did was to talk about them in terms of levels of potency, levels of degrees of being. That's what he meant. And so you get the down at 1 is just like the background, like background space-time. It's just this, not even things there at all. And then at 2, you get polarity, and so you begin to get forces, and 3, you get connections, and therefore you begin to get sort of entities and more particles, and then at 4, you can get objects and materials and so on. And he did this right up to the whole universe, you know, from 1 to 12, the whole autocratic, the level of the galaxies and so on, right at the top. And did it sort of like a kind of science.
It's an extraordinary effort. I mean, I like the picture that you've painted, starting with Gurdjieff's notion of, you know, the law of 3, the law of 7, and to which he added the 1. He associated 1, 3, 7 with being, will, and function, which was to become, and maybe was at that time, a fundamental triad itself for his writing and his work, that is being, will, and function, which is kind of interesting, choosing those 3 numbers out of the rest. And then seeing that, well, what is the property of all the numbers in between up until the 12, and using that as a, you know, sort of a great chain of being, as it were.
Exactly right, Gregory, yeah.
Because there's so much about the effort that, you know, Gurdjieff undertook, the work that Gurdjieff undertook, as well as Bennett, that reminds me of, you know, even the passage from Roger Bacon that I read the last time that we were talking, where Roger Bacon was engaged in a similar kind of work of taking the experiential sort of world and linking it to the scientific world and seeing how these are meshing with each other, not being satisfied to have them as sort of separate things. And, you know, Bennett has that, you know, medieval / Renaissance,
yes, indeed, yes.
You know, synthetic ability. You know, the Renaissance man is, you know, a hackneyed phrase, but it's fairly descriptive of the effort that he was engaged in.
This is right, and I would feel there are sort of periods of history in which this, without defining it, this sort of thinking or philosophy or engagement comes out and flourishes, and then it appears to fade away into the background or underground in some way. I'm thinking, talking about 12th century school of Chartres, which is not all that widely mentioned,
yeah.
You know, but they were into all kinds of notions of course, the sacred geometry and patterns of meaning in numerical terms, and with a philosophy of very holistic kind of philosophy, of engagement of man and nature and man with God. So man, God, and nature were much more aligned with each other than in other contexts and other periods. But that's right. So there he was, and he was starting on this. And then, you see, in the first volume, he'd made out these categories, as he called them, following Uspensky's Think in New Categories, not the old ones of the classical world. And he said, I'll do that. And he did that. He got these 12 categories now. But they had applied them specifically in this realm of the natural sciences, or in, he called it the world of fact. Going on, he had concerns beyond the world of fact, and so he got into the domain of value and so on. In his second volume, was concerned with what he called moral philosophy. Now, when he did this, then he made a whole other thing, as we have mentioned, function, being, and will, and so on. He began to look at these, or to express these numbers as categories in a very much stronger sense, so that certainly, and it changed some things. For example, you had, as we've said already, will as three. And then in volume two, being comes out as four. And you might say, well, we won't go into why he does this. And then he's got a kind of category concept of essence, which is five. And then he goes into something rather like time in the present moment events, and that's six. And so on. So he begins to make a kind of meta language, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
About whole realms of discourse. And with a kind of, it's a slightly awkward beginning to all this, with value and fact as a polarity, as a not so much a polarity, but as a dyad, as a duality, as a complementarity.
Yeah.
And how between them they create the domain of harmony. So now you've got a meta structure, you see. And so he's really got in these numbers, he's encapsulated a sort of whole metaphysics, which he went on sort of developing in various ways, because all the time he would sort of get a glimpse of something and move forward, and then he'd have to work it out, the content of the new place he'd arrived at, and then he'd get another glimpse and move forward, and so it kept on moving. And then volume three, which we mentioned before, in this, which is about human societies, I think, and structures and human societies, man and his nature. Sorry, that's right. Yeah. But yeah, sorry. About the life history of a person, the human societies, all these kinds of things. And in it, he includes a summary of the systematics itself. So by volume three, he's laying out his method. And it's very interesting, he gets to three and he does that. And then, because in the first volume he'd got sort of two, four, five, then this volume three contains a lot of references to sixes. And then you get this kind of suspicion, is he going to go on the later volumes, volume four, to the other numbers? And mostly it's in volume three. He gets up to eight and nine to a certain degree, and leaves us dangling about the other ones and some twelves. And this whole thing is repeated strongly in volume four on history. So I want to give the impression, you see here, not of so much a work in progress, because the way he was thinking, you see, is a whole intimacy between form and content in his work.
Mm-hmm.
You see, what he was trying to express depended on how he would express it, and what he was expressing was about also how he would be expressing it. You know, it's not quite convoluted, but it was a mutually evolving process.
I mean, the one idea that has been in my thinking over the last year or so is the idea of a feedback loop. And, you know, what you've just described really put me in touch with that. You know, Bennett, you know, has these tools, you know, the systematics, but it's not all complete. It's a way way that he can describe perhaps a certain region of where he's at, but then he can reflect on how he has described that,
right?
And then now use that reflection to move to the next sort of iteration of the system, including elements of, meta-awareness, as it were, seeing how far, you know, it can expand and that, what kind of descriptive power that has.
Precisely said. This excellent summary. And remind me of a few linkages to take his... paradigmatic, archetypal, primary, the earth as kind of urtext of Gurdjieff's, which is to be found in Spence's book, In Search of Miraculous, when he, in the section on symbolism, which is his lead up to the Enneagram, and Gurdjieff goes through the idea of oneness, two-ness, three-ness, four-ness, five-ness, and so on, in a very kind of discursive way, talking about the development, human development, you know, what did man do to become, to go from being twofold to threefold to fourfold? He draws a picture of this, very evocative, very approachable kind of picture. And of course, it has a resonance, sort of resonance in modern age, you know, getting beyond one-dimensional man, you know, this kind of thing, into this idea of the multidimensional man, and it's all going on in physics, the multidimensional universe. There's the spirit of it is very strongly around. But as you say, it was the you re-enter the same, and it becomes new. You use the word iteration, and it's the sort of thing we've been studied a lot now in mathematics, and is much more accessible than it was in Bennett's time. Certainly right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the idea of recursiveness, you know, that I guess who was it, Douglas Hofstadter and, you know, Gödel, Escher, Bach kind of put out into the mainstream. But I find it fascinating that, you know, having written thousands of lines of programming code that, you know, programming languages, you know, can be described recursively, where, you know, more complex units are built up recursively from simpler ones. And that in a certain way, some languages, if approached from that point of view, are very metaphysical. You know, you can start thinking about how you're thinking, you know, about the problem that you're solving.
And that's right.
Yeah.
And you don't go up your own fundament at all in this. It actually is a deeply natural process, in fact. It's not some kind of weird introspection or something like that at all.
Thing. It's a very creative thing. As long as there are periods where you are, in my opinion, you are going to step back from it and try to assimilate it into your being again. I think that's the thing that I heard in your description of Bennett's work earlier that resonated. It's, okay, we can draw fancy diagrams and we can talk about 1, 2, 3, 4, and we can... you know, use mathematics to trace out, you know, beautiful symbols of what it is that we have in mind. But at the same time, the inner content of that is the process that I'm in the midst of while I'm arriving at that, is also on the table for discussion there. And I think that that's a very important thing to be teased out, that systematics is not just a way of talking about numbers, it's a way of talking about experience as well, and about the mind, the nature of mind.
So much surfacing in this. See, I'll pick on one thing.
Please.
It's like when we're talking, you know, so I can say there's a sort of mental image of sort of sparks of light going off in all sorts of different directions, and then these become other sparks of light going off in different directions, you know, that kind of spirit of association. But I've been with a great integrator, and part of this story must be that this integration between the ancient and modern was a very strong thing for him. As I said, because of his education and so on, he was very much aware of ancient wisdom, so to speak. And of course, Gurdjieff had made a great deal about all of this, the wisdom of the ancients, at a time when it wasn't so popular as it is now. And indeed, some of Gurdjieff's message about the past and so on is now kind of very widely spread.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't in the year 1900. But this taking of what we have from ancient wisdom, for example, Pythagoras, with stuff in the modern world, and Ben was aware of, for example, I mentioned organization management and the still ongoing work about understanding organizations. You know, it's still at a very primitive stage. It's a very modern concern, and there's a lot of exploitation and simplification going on, but it's very important. It was very important for him. And the rise of people like Buckminster Fuller, the people thinking in this integrative way in the modern world, and because they want to achieve certain things. And this is very important, because you get to the modern world, you get concerned with doing things, achieving things, making things, creating things. And whereas if we're from the past, you get it rather as, as eternal ideas or convictions or beliefs or something.
Right. You've lost the context in which it really came up, which was probably very much a practical context.
Could well have been, but all we get are these sort of like images, pictures, descriptions, and all the rest of it. And Ben wasn't going to sit around. I mean, there is still an enormous number of books published about this, about number and the qualities of number, and they never give any real scholastic basis for this. It's all, in a sense, plucked out of the air. I mean, it's just because there are accumulated traditions and folklore and material to do with this come from the past, which are mostly people just repeating what has been said before and not really developing it, and it's not really looked into at all. But they give something. You know, they give a picture, they give some kind of starting point. But you need to come into the modern concerns where we have to do things to make it strong and make it substantial. And so that's where he was, to combine the ancient and the modern. And he wanted to get a language then which would appeal or be accessible to a modern person, and to eschew very largely all the traditional language almost entirely.
Hmm.
And in this, again, he was following Gurdjieff. Because, I mean, Gurdjieff's whole approach was, I mean, it was a kind of game he was playing, but appear to be kind of pseudo-scientific about everything, and not to do it in, obviously, spiritual terms, but to keep on talking about numbers and laws and combinations,
right,
and this sort of thing, and talking about
hydrogens and carbons.
Hydrogens, and it's all that question, like, how many more times is Jesus Christ intelligent than a potato? Actually, one of the most wonderful questions, and all of that. So there he was doing that. And then when about this not going round and round in it, which you mentioned. I mean, I remember talking to him about he was constantly giving lectures. He's a wonderful speaker, but all sorts of things. But he said once he got into the systematics, he'd go through the material in a systematic way, do them. To use the language, the monads, dyads, triads, tetrads, pentads, and so on, in that sequence, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, how many times, how many numbers he got to. But when he gave the lecture, he would entirely forget that.
Hmm.
Just as you said, it's exactly this, because it's like, imagine yourself in the kitchen, and you're going through all the recipe books, but then you finally got to cook a meal.
Right.
And you sort of, it's all got to go into doing something and choosing something. And this is often forgotten because it only comes to a focus in the action. That's where it is, in what you have to do. And there's the world of need and action, will, intention, that it comes to fruition. And I think that's almost can't be overemphasized. That's where it gets strong. And I'm using that word here about strength and so on. And what I have in the back of my mind, possibly it'd be helpful to bring it forward, is that, say, the stuff from the past, the ancients are like the patterns, and the modern context is like needs. There's something which brings them together. And there's always this third element, fascinated, Bennett. What really brings it together? And this is strength. This is grasp. Yeah. This is energy. This is power. This enablement, which he was concerned with. And because he had this notion of about the uncertain hold on existence, which is not only we have as people, but situations, you know. So you even talk about events being stronger or weaker, and strong events growing, even if you say it happened in our terms 2,400 years ago in Athens. No, it's still getting stronger, and it's quite contrary to ordinary thoughts about this. So there's that, you know, the sense of a pattern, and it has to be brought into a real situation and made meaningful.
The way that you put it just there in terms of, you know, patterns, which in the context that you were mentioning is the ancient sort of aspect of it, and then need in the present context, the present day, then this third element of strength, binding them together, how tightly are they going to be bound into some kind of a molecule, as it were, so that something real can happen. If things are not bound strongly, then accident or, you know, happenstance is going to be easily, shaking it apart and moving it off into something else. That's an interesting triad itself. In a personal sense, you know, I can have an idea. I can see the need to bring that idea out, as a paper or a song or a talk or something like that. And for people, I have some idea maybe of an audience that is embodying that need as well as my own need. But how strongly am I going to hold on to that in order to, I want to say realize, but at the same point, I know that Bennett made a distinction between actualizing and realizing.
I think here your realizing is correct.
No. Can you say something more about that?
Oh, I'd really love to. This is so paramount. This small anecdote may help. I don't know. When I was early days, I was teaching at a college of technology, which became University of Brunel, talking with a guy there, a very interesting guy who knew about Bennett's work in the realm of philosophy of science. And anyway, he gave an example about this mismatch, of a mismatch in this case. He said he remembered that came to the college a chap lecturing on, I think, furnaces, the structure of furnaces and design of furnaces. He said he will divide my talk into two parts. The first will be the theory, the second the practice. And so the first part of his end of the theory, the second part of the practice. But Isaacs, the chap talking to me, said, in fact, when he came onto the practice, he had nothing whatsoever to do with the theory. It was, they were completely divorced, and the man giving his talk wasn't aware. They were totally divorced. You know, there's nothing to do with it. He wasn't applying the theory at all. It was just two different streams which happened to, because there have been papers on since the 19th century on thermodynamics, and there have been people doing premises for longer than that, and so they just brought them together. And it's like that, and we know that, we know the scene in which, and I was thinking of a chap I was in touch with once as a consultant, and he was admits that he was very interested in these ideas of really what a real facilitator would do, and he isn't a controlling person, he has to be very free. And he said that when actually the moment he got into in front of his clients, whoever they were, he completely reverted to the old pattern. We all know this. This new idea doesn't take hold. And so there is something always like that. Most people, and if I may impose this judgment upon my fellow men, they're radically divorced. I mean, it's like in traditional industry and organizations, of course, the people with the forms and the ideas are one, and the people who do anything are the other. And they very much say in England, or something, haven't done, talked with each other at all. So what is the thing which could bind them together? And so it's enormous very practical application, and because of this split in the discourse, you know, people can actually be buffered in such a way they don't realize they're switching into different domains of experience and without any connection between them. They're just flipping. And this is what Goethe called buffering. So they get in, you get people explaining what they're doing, and it has nothing to do with what they do. Again, a story of a friend of mine was into martial arts Aikido, and he had the Japanese masters. I saw them and saw this guy. He was great. He'd do so. But his description of what he was doing didn't match what he actually did. He was a master at the movement doing it, but when he came to describe it, it was just fantasy. And similar things happen in the realm of some parts of technology. You know, you find engineers with those weird ideas about what they're doing, which has got no connection with what they're actually doing. So it's a profound thing, and then we better perhaps draw back from this. It's so vast, this buffering or schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Or whatever you call.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps even to use Gurdjieff's way of framing it, different brains, you know.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You know, I'm talking about, you know, this idea, and one part of my brain system is, you know, quite happy to talk about that. And now that I'm, you know, engaged, my hands are moving and I'm doing something, another part of my brain system is now working. And to, you know, create the triad, as it were, or invoke the triad to bring these somehow together, I don't know, I'm difficult. There's a work. I think
it's a work.
Part of it has to be that you have to know, you have to see for yourself that two things are occurring separately from each other. If you can see that, or in some way sense it, feel it perhaps even, then that's a start.
It is. This is very well. So you're getting into already very rapidly into this practicality of this sort of stuff. And this is like I said, the original translation of Trio Mazzucano, I put three together in do. It's a very profound sentence and statement. Because you have to get the three have to be independent. You know, this is this notion. It's absolutely crucial, subtle, deep, and immensely profound and far-reaching. This, you have to get these independent elements to cooperate. And so these themes of cooperation, and his favorite word of Mr. Venn is synergy, which means, you know, together, energy together, working together, are so strongly prominent, they can't be overemphasized at all. Now, as Gurdjieff's formulation, as you know, is that understanding requires all three centers in terms of your descriptions of different brains. And if you have only two brains, this is partial understanding. If you have one brain, that's misunderstanding. But you can imagine, you know, your work in education. This is completely unknown in the educational world. That you, you know, to understand something, you must not only think it, you must feel it and do it. Without the doing part of it, you don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's a it's a good definition of what education is, in my opinion, that you're trying to bring a description of something into contact with the practice of something in a way where the person, you know, actualizing it is can mediate it. Not necessarily by putting their fingers in there, but allowing the mediation to occur even sometimes. In my writing class, we're writing short stories at the moment. And, you know, I can hand out and have handed out all kinds of wonderful examples of short stories. And we read them and we, you know, point out, okay, here's, you know, here isn't this wonderful the way that the author has created this tension just in these two sentences, and how she's heightened the contrast by choosing these words. So we can have that wonderful conversation, and then okay, let's write a short story. Okay, we can read out our stories to each other, and then say, okay, well, what techniques are you using in this paragraph? Were you aware of, or even if you weren't, are you aware now, looking at it, you know, as a reader, are you aware of what techniques are you're using? That's a very difficult conversation. To get myself to that level as a student of writing, it's very challenging to make that connection. And I wonder often, why is it so challenging? Why is it so difficult to get these two elements in cooperation with a third one, which is I often see as a communication a container of communication. I don't know if that's painting a clear picture, but if a student or myself can say, yes, I'm using this technique here consciously, I'm striving to see what I can do with this technique, that is a, and if I come back at it again and again until I can see that, oh yes, I am really using this technique well here, which to me is success, you know, when that happens. How do we strengthen that?
Well, this is, again, an enormous topic. I'll try and say three things, if I can possibly remember three things, you know, to remember two things is something remarkable for me sometimes. And it used a very unfashionable sort of word, which you probably couldn't possibly use in your classes, and that's suffering. You've got to suffer. To do anything, you've got to suffer. Meaningful. This is it's partly linguistic uncertainty here about, you know, because the word originally had lots of meanings to do with allowing. And it's not to be miserable at all. That means if you suffer, it means something's happening to you. You see, you are being engaged in this, and that's the wonderful thing. So that's the one whole avenue in itself, and I'm very keen on it because I feel it's like Nietzsche says, write with blood and I will find their spirit. This is unmistakable, and you can hardly introduce such things into education these days because you probably get the sack or something.
Well, you might not be able to use those words. You might have to be clever about reframing it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you can be in that. The other way, as you know well, Gregory, is, of course, is the thing, the 10,000 things. You know, you don't get anywhere until you've done it 10,000 times. And there's no getting around to this. You know, it's like the first one about suffering is really new with the feelings and the 10,000 times to do with the body. There are fundamental realities here which are very precious. Well, the third thing I wanted to say is that it's a mysterious element, a core element in Gurdjieff's treatment. It comes out so strongly in his third series of writings, Life is Real Then Only When I Am, when he makes very strong references in three or four places to this thing about the three centers and the I. And it is only when these three come together that there is I. And it's a kind of chicken and egg situation. Where does the I come from? You know, in order to come together, how do they agree? How do they come to cooperate? And you can picture, well, I have to bring the three together, but you know, you don't exist before the three come together. You're not there.
Right.
So it's a beautiful conundrum here. And I'll just leave it at that as the conundrum, because it's the real realm of work. You know, there is that. You know, if you spell it out in words logically, it's a contradiction. It's an impossibility. You can't lift yourself up by your own bootlaces. But you can get a sense of it, this cooperation. And that has a strong, for me, very, very strong resonances. And a very, you know, when people really explain it very well, but has to do with the great significance for me that Western music is based on chords and Eastern music is not. And you think, well, what is Blake going on about now? Chords and Western and Eastern music, and why is this in it? But this is part of systematics. You begin to see these patterns spilling over in different directions. I brought it in part also to refer to music, something which Bennett never did. He never got into the incredible role that what we can call, and it's clumsily called, a theory of musical harmony played in all the early civilizations. I mean, this is way before the Greeks. There were structures to do with understanding the scales and based on the simple numerical ratios. And it would even sound quite complex. There are tablets going back 4,000 years with numerical schemes which encompass all sorts of heptatonic scales. And it's because the mystery, the phenomenological mystery in music about sameness and other, which is in the octave, you know, do, do. Yeah. I'm probably out of tune. I did that, but you see, the two, you sound the two together, and you say they're the same. And this is recognized all around the world. You know, yeah. It's the same. And if you measure it exactly, it's not precisely the same, but okay, it's the same. It's double the frequency, and this was the basis investigation over 5,000 or more years to do with these patterns. And so the fifth, you know, which is the ratio of 3 and 2, and the fourth, 4 and 3, and the third, 5 and 4, and so on, all play an enormous role. And they're built, and people are still investigating this whole phenomenology of music. And I'm myself so excited that people are now willing and able to look at music as thinking, because the old-fashioned way, because it just, oh, it's emotion. I say, fine, yeah, it is emotion, but it's also thinking, just like Beethoven said, and all this kind of thing. And I should be, when I go over my seminar in May, I hope to meet up with my old friend, 97-year-old Ernest MacLean, who I always recommend to everybody, his works, The Myth of Invariance, particularly his classic work of the 70s, which exposes the structure of ancient texts in Babylonian, Egyptian, Greek, Chinese, Indian cultures as having a base, a kind of spine structure, conventional structure based on music. He was a pioneer in exposing this, and is so unexpected in human thought. Now, I'm going to jump away from that because I want, time is going on, and say something about the actual systems and the motivation behind them. The fun, is like I mentioned, the things in music about ratios, 3 to 2, but you can look at them now also as the transition. Also, this is transition from 2 to 3. Now, that statement itself might seem as empty and vacuous as anything possible statement can be. And who cares how you go from 2 to 3, you add 1. No, it's like a total revolution in one's universe. Why? Because in classical logic, Aristotelian, you have yes and no, true and false, black and white, all this sort of thing. And this has dominated every, you know, our Western thought for more than 2,000 years.
Yeah.
And is
the heart of the binary computer, for sure.
Well, yeah, that's another side of it. It's true. It is a body. That's where it's put to use. It's quite true. And that's good you mentioned that. You go from computer to Aristotle to logic, but also to, like, courts of law, all the legality and so on, so much based on a binary system, true and false, and it's called the adversarial system. And it goes back, you can see it goes back to feudal times and before that, medieval times and savage times. You know, you decide a dispute by people fighting it out. Now you've got lawyers doing it for you. Yeah. Used to be people with swords. But anyway, it's all about, you know, answer my question, sir. Yes or no, yes or no. You know, that's the whole interrogation regime. It's forcing into, everything's forced into dyadic terms in the courts of law and in logic. And you look at newspapers, they have issues coming up, and they put a column yes and a column no. And anybody who's investigated anything, dwelt on anything, and said, for God's sake, man, there's yes, no, and there's interesting.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is always what is not entirely yes and not entirely no. And so it's not fuzzy either. It's ingenious. It's new. It's a subtle point of view. So we need this logic of the three. Have been in the 20th century attempts to get to this logic of the three. Now, look at the history of this, or a particular historical context. That is to say, in the Western world, it's been hovering throughout the whole of its existence, you know, sort of past 2,000 years or so, or almost 2,000 years ago. Of course, the Trinity of Christianity. Now, it was always treated in the church as a mystery beyond reason, because reason was identified with this either-or-ness. But now we come to back to the psychological thing. If you can be faced with a choice, realm of choice, you have to do this or do that, and there is that kind of reality. But you know that realm of choice is also enslavement. You know, whatever choice you make is also belonging to that enslavement in that choice. And that there is a different thing in the triad. There is a movement. And it goes on moving. And that's why Bennett, with talking with us young chaps, called it, you know, dynamism.
Mm-hmm.
It moves, you know, like Galileo says, it moves. And I myself return to or refer to a physics example in this. That is to say, in what's called the three-body problem, which I find absolutely gripping problem in celestial mechanics, which is still being investigated. And you've got to imagine just empty space, and you've got three bodies, you know, you've got, say, the masses, and they're nearest to each other, and they're moving around. And the situation is, in most circumstances, you can't predict what they will do.
Mm-hmm.
With two, you can, absolutely. With three, you can't. In certain special cases, you can. But there's very special cases. And I suddenly, this is amazing. You know, you jump into a totally different reality with three. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely different. And there's a degree of freedom, and you can begin to feel it. You know, if you're in the two, I'm forced between this or that, speak now, you know. That's when you get into the realm of the three, that you're looking back on that is hell. Now, I use an emotional term like hell because I want to bring out the emotion of this. You know, in a way, each system, from the point of view of a higher system, is a hell. Hmm. And the higher system is a heaven. I like to use that metaphor. Why? Because the heaven has got this, these further degrees of freedom, more is possible. And this is a very profound thing, which, you know, I'm writing my book, I'm trying to address it, but failing terribly because it's so important, absolutely important, that you have these different possibilities in these different higher realms. You can live differently. And so what appears to be freedom, you go to this other step, you see, was slavery. You were a robot. And this interplay between being a robot and being a free being is being played out amongst these abstract, in being portrayed in these abstract systems of the monad, the one, dyad, the two, triad, the three, tetrad, the four, pentad, the five, and so on. So these really have to do with patterns of possibility. And the close proximity of this to ideas in physics, which I touched upon earlier, of these many dimensions, which gripped Bennett when he was young, because he was a young lad, around 1900, there was a tremendous vogue of interest in the higher dimensions.
Yeah.
And he, as a young guy, he was doing these visualization exercises they had see what was it, what would a four-dimensional cube look like. And they're actually visualizing it and seeing it in ways which people now have forgotten. So, but anyway, the point is, the going from the two to the three is so profound. This is what Bennett built his career on this. He would attend conferences to do with fuel research and so on, and listen to the speakers, and they would fall into this dyadic pattern, this and that and so on. And he turned to the triad and asked a question pointing to the triad in the situation.
Hmm.
And so he built up a reputation as somebody who knew something.
Well, it's a fascinating expositional journey that you just gave us. We started with the ratio of the fifth, and then you segued into the transition of two to three. And talking about the two, I mean, that was really resonant for me because I had just been having this conversation this week because I was teaching debate.
Ah.
And, okay, here we are. This is a fundamental element of all of Western culture. The two-sided debate is in our courts, it's in our parliament, it's in our law, like, you know, the legal system all the way through, you know, it's in our schools, it's just endemic, you know, this model of the debate, whether it's taking place, informally or formally.
Indeed.
And it also occurred to me, somebody like, Robert Anton Wilson, who really did, in as much as I've been able to research his talks and so forth, was big on popularizing the three. You know, he had this term, maybe logic, which I think he picked up.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, and he was a real exponent. It's really at the core of his teaching that, which I think he picked up from Heidegger, if I'm not mistaken, maybe logic. You know, yes, no, maybe. And he, the way that he weaves it throughout his talks and the way that he deconstructs social structures, you know, social understandings and different ways in which we engage as being limited by this two-valued logic. So the meme is out there. Perhaps we're on the verge of moving, you know, allowing different values in our way of constructing society, a way of seeing ourselves. But it's not going to go away easily, this two-value system, right? Because clearly,
politics, they always revert back to the dyad in politics.
Sure, because, you know, it has then to do with material control.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And one of the quotes from your talk that I wrote down, the one that you gave in Milan last year, it may be relevant. Mind is hated by authorities everywhere. Because with mind, you get human beings. You can think, and that's a threat.
That is a threat. Mind is authority. I mean, oh, wow. I mean, this is, you know, like, it's an endless topic in itself again, Gregory. I think because you mentioned Wilson, and I cite Korzybski, Science right. and Sanity.
That's right, and he was really influenced by Korzybski, yeah.
And who then influenced, of course, the science fiction writer Van Vogt. And those who remember the Nalle novels of Van Vogt. And he tries to portray this person who can think differently, playing a role in the spaceship community and this sort of thing. So it's sort of out there, but particularly, we mentioned in Milan and so on, in dialogue, of course, the switch you can find in, if there is a sense in which, you know, the conversation between a reasonable number of people reaches dialogue, it's when it gets triadic. And then you get, because you get then this movement, and it's the recreation of meaning, whereas in the dyad, you tend to get more this fixation and polarization, which makes it static and held. But I want to now throw in another sort of semi-advert in a way,
yep.
because I looked into this. To preface it, I'm going to talk about dialogue a little bit and the science of dialogue, so to speak. But to preface it with the notion that I talked earlier about the lower systems relative to the higher being hell and so on. These are just a kind of just evocative, metaphorical, expressive words. Because also in a way, and Bennett was very strong on this, he said each has its own virtue. And now I've gone down the path of sort of condemning the two and praising the three, which is allowable. But we must remember background, I can call it theology, attitude, worldview, feeling, sense that Bennett had, and which I feel I largely share, was that the lower is not bad.
Right.
How to say it? It has its virtues, and at times it is very important. And this is an ongoing, really, really profound thing for humankind. You may not be religious at all in any ordinary sense of the word, but it's still there, very, very powerfully. There is this issue, because most people these days, less and less, can understand, you know, if you have God and so on, you know, why is there suffering, you know, why doesn't he help, why is there higher intelligence, why doesn't it solve the problems of the world? And you've really got to understand these things. They're very important kind of questions. Whereas all around, you know, that in this notion of synergy, which I mentioned, see, synergy originally was a heresy in the Christian church, and because there was the idea only God could save man, and man himself couldn't do anything to save himself. You know, whatever salvation means in the spiritual sense. And this is very, powerful element around in the Christianity search with Christ as the Redeemer, as the Helper, as the Enabler, and his a relationship to the being of Christ, that it meant, you know, it was actually a heresy, the idea that man could work on himself and help save his soul.
Right.
It was a heresy and condemned by those people. But it's now there's something we want to do. And the synergic epoch, as Bennett conceived it, was of all these different levels. He said there are different levels of being and so on. But they can cooperate together, and it doesn't mean that the top one has got to take control of everything. And so it's a kind of very seemingly impossible task to make sense of this. Anyway, with the two, we know the power of it in philosophy, of course, with Kierkegaard, his famous either or. He turns it into this extraordinary act, you know, the leap of faith and so on. Because why? Because it's you're faced with an impossibility, he uses it to develop and strengthen a contradiction in our existence to the point where you only have to, the only thing you do is make a free act, and that's his act of faith. Now, strangely, this is the same, I'm hesitating the word, the same, in this system of innovation, the Russian system called TRIZ, which I'm very fascinated by, which concentrates on contradiction. He said, you only get this creative step by entering deeply into the contradiction. Wow. You increase the contradiction.
Right.
It's like Rumi used to say, evolution comes only from necessity. Increase then your necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like that. So the diet has something in it. And so what I looked at in terms of dialogue was, what could I find corresponding to the first four systems, because it gets very tricky after that, for people talking together. Now, you get people talking together, you've got things in time. One, you know, chat, 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 and the other person goes da, 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 and you say one thing after another. This is speech. This is what we're doing now. This is what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's so, the notion of this kind of pattern, a relationship, is sort of hovering somewhere. I mean, how does this get translated into this chat, 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 chat sort of business? And so the one term I use in this is, of course, roles. And people involved in this can play roles. And so we have the idea of a one-fold role, a two roles, three roles, and four roles. And it gets very, very interesting, because let's take these two roles. Okay, they are different, and so they start with difference. Now, there's one way of proceeding with this, where the two, Mr. A and Mr. B, and act and so as to, when they speak, to increase their difference. Make them more and more different. Because one thing I say, Gregory, that really bedevils everything is compromise.
Mm-hmm.
This is so, it becomes very inhuman. It seems a nice thing to do, but it's very inhuman. And in Tris's
Well, what I was going to jump in and say, if you don't mind.
Go on.
The compromise aspect of it is problematic if the energy of the current system has not played itself out yet. And what I mean by that is, I conceived of a new form of debate when you were talking there. Okay, let's say two sides are debating, and they do their best to present their case, and you accent the difference as you're speaking to. Then what if they, the next step, that's the dyadic step. Now they're going to sit together and watch a videotape of their debate, and they'll now move more into a three mode, where they'll deconstruct not only their own case, but their colleague's case, at which point they might arrive at a compromise, but it's not at the expense of undergoing the dyadic engagement.
Yeah, it's like using the dyad as raw material.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense of, if one system is going to lead into the next, make sure we till the earth of that first one well.
Oh, that's absolutely right. This tilling the earth well is very, very important. My approach, what I did, in fact, three, it's different from what you've just outlined. Sticking to the two. You've got three modes. Mode one is where they working with each other to create these differences, because they need to work together to make them more and more different.
Right.
Then, as I said, because I took the phrase, you must know it very well, Gregory, yes, but.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at most or hear most conversations, they have mostly that form. Yes, because I want to sound as if I'm nice.
That's right.
With you. But I've got my own ideas and not yours, and yours are wrong.
Right.
Now, we split it and go, into no but and yes and.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredible. I haven't done it for some time now. I've done it with some groups. It's an incredible process. If you get into the yes and, you have to amplify the meaning of what the other person says.
Yeah.
Creatively amplify it. Keep on doing this and keep on doing it as far as you can.
Bravo. I mean, what you're talking about, it really resonating with me. I'm triggering a lot of associations. But a few years back, I studied improv with a teacher in Toronto for a couple of sessions, improv comedy. And one of the first rule you learn is the rule of yes and. So that when, that when you get up, you know, here it is, and the fellow walks in the room and he presents you with something. And you, yes, and, you know, you take it to the next step. The worst thing that you can do, well, as a beginner, is to get into the no but pattern until you become very good at what you're doing.
Yes.
So the yes and is going to amplify and get you working together. And then later you might introduce the no but as a kind of, as long as you're skilled enough not to close the dialogue off.
That's right. That's perfectly right. That's practical sense. Good sense that. Now let's go on to the third one. It's more subtle, but it's interesting. I've done it a few times. It's so interesting. Where the two people consider themselves to be one person.
Hmm.
Then I have to go back now to monologue. You see, you have this word monologue, one person talking. I talk about monologue from monad. And it's amazing. I'm so frustrated I haven't done more of this. I've done it with some people. It's absolutely amazing. It seems stupidly simple. And what you do is you get one person talking. And they just go on and they go on. And I experimented in little days to get, because this is in the context, of course, of an audience. The audience, and this is, it becomes a very interesting area, so has to support that person, energize that person. I originally had people play the role of it, making encouraging noises. Oh, yes, tell me more, and this sort of thing, and voicing it. And I said, no. Eventually I got rid of that. They just listen. And the person feels this listening and does it. Anyway, so that's the prior thing to the dialogue, which is D-Y-A, log, dia.
Okay.
Do I do that?
Yeah.
I have to fancy the language a bit, you see. So like you were saying about you need to get into the yes and before to the yes but, and so here, this third mode about treating it as one voice, you need to have the experience of the monologue of this. You just go on. You said something. And it's what you mentioned about reiteration. You said something, and so you can say something more. So you can say something more. It doesn't matter where the hell it goes. A few times I've done this, and people have gone into this different kind of space, as you imagine it. Now, I found this absolutely riveting. Now, the trilogue as such, here, this is my breakthrough point, which I haven't really got beyond, which is years back. I thought, okay, try it. You know, you've got this act in Gurdjieff terms, and that we'd have another discourse to go on about this terminology. It's part about the child. But you have basically active, receptive, and neutralizing various forms of those words and concepts. And I said, okay, we've got to set up with these three. Now we have three roles. So I took the most direct ones I could find, were the sort of the active, the proposing. Mm-hmm. Called this the I actually see why in a moment. Called it the answering, the question. I made the receptive, and the answering as the active, and then the commenting as the reconciling. And it starts from the question, of course. Now, we haven't got time to go into it here, but in a way, part of the formalism Bennett did, which means that this form has the form of evolution. You know, it should develop, it should get higher. Because somebody asks a question, then the next person, B, has to give an answer. Even if they don't feel like it, they don't know anything, they give an answer. And the third person comments on the relationship between the question and the answer, and which gives rise to a new question, and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I found this work, you know, it depends. All these things, you know, Gregory, the law of three, in the sense of a third of the people really go for it, a third won't get it, and a third are kind of muddled through. This is the sort of thing one gets with techniques and methods. But some people take off on this, and it's just great because I began to see that, of course, the triad was connected with the root cause, the root nature of creativity. This is where creativity really starts, is with the triad, and in fact where thought starts really with the triad. And remind me, if you've got a few minutes left, to talk about where we got this from. So that the people responding are just in that small present moment, they're just kind of, oh my God, I got to come up with a question. They're kind of coming up with a question, something. Oh, I got to come up with an answer. I got to come up with an answer. So you've got to concentrate on that, their bit, so to speak. But if it gels, then you get this like a circuit set up.
Right.
And you get it immediately, don't you? And you've seen it probably many times. And the circuit is creative.
Yeah.
So you can, in a sense, have the roles. The people playing the roles are not themselves creative, but together they're creative. And I thought, this is bloody exciting. It's really fascinating. This is really great.
I just want to remind listeners that, okay, what we're hearing from Anthony is a sketch of what you might, what you will find yourself in the midst of if you head out to that workshop in May, along with, you know, a lot of other material as well. But Tony, you've done a lot of work in creating practical situations where people can get in touch with the inner quality of these systems, so that they are not kind of abstract figures on a page. And that is, you know, really important work. This is just a short passage from Volume 3 of The Dramatic Universe. Quote, "In the study of structures, we cannot separate what we understand from what we are, nor can we separate what a thing is from the way it is known. Since no human mind has a synthetic and creative power great enough to reproduce as a mental image the total organized complexity of the world presented to us from moment to moment, we need a means of simplifying the task. This is provided by systematics. Systematics is the study of structures as simplified totalities. Analytics breaks structures down into their simplest elements and looks for the connections between these elements. Systematics, by contrast, takes the connections as primary and the elements as secondary." End quote.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed this. I've got really off on it. Thanks a lot.
Likewise. Tony, it's a pleasure, and I'm hoping that our listeners will feel the same way. Idiot Players podcast is available for download at idiotplayers.org. Any republication in whole or in part of this podcast must include a pointer back to idiotplayers.org.